Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the first section of the 12th module of the History of Christianity 2 course. Back in the 10th module, we looked at the various responses to the movement we called modernism. We saw a bad response in theological liberalism and various better responses, one of which was called fundamentalism. In this section, we'll continue that story and the history of the movements that were all lumped together under the umbrella term of fundamentalist at that time. In this section, we'll look at the gradual separation between fundamentalists and a movement that is typically known as evangelicals. The term evangelicals was used about the Reformation, and in another sense, this movement started with the Great Awakenings in Britain and North America. But more narrowly, I'm using the term evangelicals to refer to the bridge between the fundamentalists we talked about in a previous section and much of the current church in North America. And we'll survey how that group grew out of the fundamentalists and transitioned into much of what we know today. And we'll start with the timeline as usual to see how these things relate to the history we've already examined. I'll remind you that theological liberalism had been around since at least the 1700s and really had a lot of influence in the 1800s and early 1900s. The Fundamentals were published from 1910 through 1915. And Machen split from Princeton to form Westminster Seminary in 1929. All of that's from earlier sections. However, most of this section covers big trends over the first half of the 20th century, with consequences that last until today. We're covering overall approaches, and there are no clear points of time when things changed because they developed over time. So I won't give any specific dates for people or events, except for the Scopes trial, which took place in 1925. Now, let's jump into the history of the fundamentalists and evangelicals. And we'll start by briefly reviewing the responses to modernism and theological liberalism. Like the sports metaphor, some played offense, doing church and scholarship better in order to advance the cause of Christ, and some played defense, directly responding to and protecting the church from the errors of theological liberalism, so that the church did not move backwards. One of the defensive moves was the publishing of a series of works called The Fundamentals, to expose and counter the errors of theological liberalism. And this highlighted a clear and growing division between the liberals and fundamentalists. At that time, fundamentalist was the label given to those who were faithful Orthodox Christians, who rejected theological liberalism and the abandonment of biblical Christianity that the liberals were advocating. And there were a wide variety of churches, traditions, and approaches that were under the umbrella term fundamentalist at that time. That's all a review of what we saw in the earlier section. Now, let me give you some more history that happened after those things, but is still background for this module's topic. With the start of World War I, and all the horrible death and destruction, and with the Great Depression and collapse of the economy around the world, the optimism and hope in human progress which characterized modernism collapsed in the minds of many people. The horrible things experienced at that time showed that the naive optimism of humanism was a fantasy, disconnected from the real world. And the inability of theological liberalism to give any answers or comfort in those situations showed it to be empty as well. And so, the door was opened for a move away from modernism and theological liberalism back to Orthodox Christianity. That is to say, there was a shock and reality check that revealed the shortcomings of modernism and theological liberalism, and this led many to become disillusioned with them and reject them. Some moved on to different errors, but some were open to returning to the truth of the earlier Christian worldview. And in the faithful church, this strengthened the resolve against theological liberalism. Over time, the churches developed a variety of responses and approaches to moving forward. So let me describe a few general categories of response by Christians in this larger period, responding both to modernism and theological liberalism. One response was to fight it on its own turf and on its own terms. This response basically assumed the presuppositions, arguments, and issues of the modernists and responded in kind. kind of like a soccer player trying to compete with a hockey player in a hockey arena. They were out of their element and working from a position of weakness. And in many ways, they set themselves up for failure at the start. For example, liberalism had said that the Bible is not good science. So this approach responded, the Bible is so good science. But in doing so, they started to read their Bibles largely in order just to defend the science of the Bible. And so for some, the Bible soon became no more than a science textbook, because they had bought into the false assumption that naturalistic science was the standard of all truth. Now, for the record, I believe the Bible is correct on everything it teaches, including scientific topics, and I believe that good science is a relatively trustworthy discipline, but anyone who's ever been told to shut up and follow the science knows that it is not infallible. However, the Bible is so much more than that, and we can't lose everything else to only address the scientific topics. Just because the modernist puts the emphasis on scientific topics does not mean that the Christians should put their own emphasis only on scientific topics. And similarly, liberalism said that the Bible has errors. So some rightly responded that the Bible has no errors. But then they were sidetracked to read their Bible only to find solutions to supposed errors. And that also would be a mistake, which reduces our concern far narrower than what it should be. By buying into the false assumption that humans can judge all truth on our own autonomous standards. Just because the modernist focuses on supposed errors does not mean that this should be the major focus of Christians. Of course, that does not mean that we grant that the Bible does have errors or let those accusations stand. Neither can we allow that autonomous humans can place ourselves as judge of what is right and wrong. Christians do need to respond to heresy and challenges, but at the same time, that needs to be only a small part of what we do. We need to do apologetics to defend the truth, but we also need to live under the truth, to live out the truth, and proclaim the whole truth with the right proportion and priorities. Our apologetics should never determine our theology. Our theology should always determine our apologetics. Our agenda and focus needs to be set by God through the whole counsel of God, and not set by the enemies of the faith. We should fight against error, but never on the enemy's terms. We should primarily be active, not reactive. Take the fight to the enemy on God's terms and with God's weapons. Now, I could give more examples, but at the heart of this issue is the fact that the modernist presuppositions were, at best, only partially true, or only part of the whole truth. So we cannot buy into those mistaken ideas or allow them to be the rules of the debate. If we take modernism as the primary authority, as the standard of judgment, it will skew everything towards falsehood. We should understand and respond to modernist presuppositions, but do it from the standpoint of God's revelation. And we should never give in to them or assume them or agree with them as our authority. Rather, we should evaluate them in terms of a better biblical primary authority. And then, a second category of unhelpful response was anti-intellectualism. Now, this reaction is understandable considering the circumstances. Back then, people looked at the theological liberals who flourished in the world of scholarship and philosophy, and Christians saw that when they sent their children to the universities, they came back as unbelievers because of what they were taught there. They saw that the errors of the liberals supposedly came from studying and education, and so they concluded that they want nothing to do with that. And many swung the pendulum to the other extreme. They had supposed that all education led to evil and unbelief, so they became wary of being intellectual and thinking about theological topics. Many were therefore content with a shallow, untheological faith based primarily on their feelings and certain traditions, and some even insisted on it. However, the antidote to bad knowledge, bad philosophy, and bad education is not no knowledge, philosophy, and education. The antidote is good knowledge, good philosophy, and good education under the authority of God and His Word. We need to love the Lord our God with all of our mind, among other things, and build our thinking upon the fear of the Lord. The cure for error is not ignorance, but truth. And we should never settle for choosing between being spiritual and being thoughtful. Choose both. Historically, it can be shown that those who choose anti-intellectualism do not get more spiritual and godly. They usually get worse and end up in dangerous and silly places. So don't skip studying to pray, and don't skip prayer to study. Rather, do both, and even combine both. Prayerfully study and pray deep, theologically informed prayers. Because it's never whether we will have theology and intellectual work. It's only a question of which kind of theology and intellectual work we will have. Yes, of course, some have done arrogant, unbelieving theology based on humanity's pride in our own autonomous intelligence, insight, and scientific progress. But we should not respond to that by overreacting into an arrogant, pietistic ignorance, which is devoid of discernment and lacking thoughtful exploration of all the implications of God's revelation. Rather, we should humbly pursue the truth with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Then a third response, which others had to modernism and theological liberalism, was to flee from the world into a separatist fortress mentality. This is similar in principle to the monastic response we saw in the History of Christianity 1 course. Good Christians disengaged from what they thought to be the compromised secular world. If the institution which used to be Christian and had been taken over by theological liberalism had turned irredeemably secular, it is good in many ways to withdraw from it, to protect yourself and your Christian witness, and to no longer contribute to an institution that is now serving darkness instead of light. So many withdrew from unfaithful institutions and started alternate institutions that were conspicuously Christian and faithful. Remember, for example, Machen left Princeton to form Westminster Theological Seminary in order to separate from liberalism and to give a better option for the Orthodox. And because they had seen the disastrous impact of the social gospel and other progressive ideas for social engineering, they rejected those approaches as well. They thought they were false idols which trusted only in man and were therefore a foolish waste of time. Now, like the other two responses, this was an understandable and reasonable response to a certain extent. But like the previous two, in many cases, the pendulum swung too far in the opposite direction. When the Christians abandoned the mainstream institutions, those institutions got worse, and the Christians were removed from the centers of power and influence, which made the rest of the society worse. Before long, much of the secular society went rotten without the presence of Christian salt to preserve it. And another problem with this approach is that it subtly, or not so subtly, trained Christians to keep their faith private. And so some Christians bought the lie and tried to separate their private inward faith from a public outward faith and lifestyle, which is actually impossible to do. For example, if your faith does not impact your secular job in any way, then the assumptions of your secular job have shrunk and neutered your faith. Now, I'm not saying you should neglect your work to sermonize at your job site, but you should explore how Christ teaches you to behave on your job. And you should do your job and deal with your coworkers and clients in a distinctively Christian manner. You should be noticeably different from your non-Christian coworker, because Jesus is Lord at your job as much as he is Lord at your church. So ask yourself how you can best serve him there as well. And because you're the same person who goes to your church on Sunday when you go to your job on Monday. And if your church life is not transforming your work life, then you are being conformed to the mindset of your work life. We all need a whole life faith that appropriately determines how we live 24/7. Now, hopefully I've communicated this in such a way that you recognize that each of these responses all have some truth and were appropriate responses to a certain extent. but hopefully you also recognize that each had some serious weaknesses. And we can ask, could there have been a better overall response? But before we get there, I want to reinforce the difficulty of this tension that these people were in, at least at that point in history, because it is very similar to the tension that we all live under today. On the one hand, we cannot be influenced by the evil world. We need, in some sense, to be removed from the world and its evil influence. In Revelation chapter 18, the risen Christ commanded his people to come out and be separate so that his people do not share in Babylon's sins. And we're commanded not to love the world or anything in it, because the love of the world is incompatible with the love of the Father. And yet, on the other hand, we are commanded to be in the world as salt and light. We should be a positive influence on the people and society around us. And that means we should be godly, intelligent, well-spoken people who engage and influence for the good, not narrow-minded, stupid bigots who only throw stones from afar and then run away. Now, don't get me wrong, you will still be called narrow-minded bigots if you disagree with the prevailing worldview, but we need to make sure this is a false accusation without ever compromising our principles. Now, all of that was introduction to an informal split that developed between different kinds of Christians in that period. And this was based on different responses to this tension, sometimes in the ways we just examined. We have already seen the Protestants had already split from the Roman Catholics, who had already split from the Eastern Orthodox, and Protestants later split into fundamentalism and liberalism, the Orthodox and the heretical. And later, the faithful Orthodox groups eventually split into two approaches that became known as fundamentalism and evangelicalism. Or, to put this in another way, in a previous section, we summarized different responses to modernism. Some embraced modernism, those were the theological liberals. Some rejected modernist culture and separated from it. Those became known as the fundamentalists. And some rejected modernist culture, but still engaged with it. Those became known as the evangelicals. So there was an informal split between two camps of those Christians who both rejected modernism. This division ran across denominational, social, and ethnic lines. There was no formal agreement or organizational split, or even an event that caused this division. It's just that different Christians and churches pursued different overall approaches and grew apart. And the labels fundamentalist and evangelical are typically used to describe either methodology. Now, those terms are not completely fair or accurate, because as we've seen, the term fundamentalist was used for a while in a positive sense to designate all those who rejected modernism. And the term evangelical, in most senses, accurately applies to both groups and goes back at least to the Reformation. But unfortunately, those are the terms that stuck, so they're the terms I will use, trying to be careful to distinguish in which sense they are being used. And sometimes I'll do that by using the phrase separatist fundamentalist in contrast to evangelicals. The fundamentalists, in this newer sense of the term, became more and more defensive, separate, and anti-intellectual over time. Now, not every fundamentalist reacted exactly the same, but at least one of these partial and inadequate responses we just examined was typically a characteristic of the later separatist fundamentalists. They were more separated, both doctrinally, but also socially and culturally. Their faith became more privatized, and therefore more stagnant and pharisaical in many cases. Again, to be fair, there was a large variety within this overall movement, and not all were as bad as others. But that separateness and fortress mentality was a hallmark of this larger movement. I'll say it again, that defensiveness and withdrawal is a legitimate and even necessary part of an effective and faithful strategy, and it only became a weakness to the extent that it became the only strategy. And that one-sidedness is the main characteristic that distinguishes the separatist fundamentalists from the evangelicals. Now, here's where I want to briefly mention the Scopes Monkey Trial, because it is so often connected with fundamentalism. One way of looking at the history is fairly simple. The state of Tennessee passed a law to prevent teaching evolution because they considered it an unproven hypothesis being used to indoctrinate children into atheism. A man named Scopes broke that law. It was proved in court, and he was fined. But the other side of the story is actually fairly sinister. And because of the way this story has been told and repeated, the story you may have heard might not be the real story. Scopes actually broke that law because he was recruited to do so by a political organization with the intent of making a publicity stunt out of the trial. And that's exactly what happened. There was actually no true creationist arguing on either side of the trial. It was a battle between two lawyers and politicians, who both were equally uninformed on the science and the Bible. The supposed evidence used to argue for the evolution side has long since been discredited. This trial really turned into a battle of propaganda, not a battle of truth. And it turned into a media circus, where only one side controlled what was reported because of a biased media. And the disinformation was magnified by a slanted play and later movie called Inherit the Wind. These productions were very biased and loose with the truth. But the propaganda had more impact than the actual events of the trial. In the play and movie, it's portrayed as the momentous struggle between the ignorant haters of truth and the enlightened champions of scientific progress. It was not about science, but it was really a struggle for freedom from oppressive tradition and narrow-minded bigotry. Now, that kind of spin was very similar to the deceptive strategies that theological liberals had been using. And the purpose of this propaganda was to portray Christians as ignorant anti-science bumpkins who prevent thought and who are oppressors of truth and freedom. And unfortunately, the propaganda significantly worked. So if you've heard anything about this trial before, it's most likely that you heard the version where a good guy teacher was persecuted by small-minded religious bigots, the bad guy prosecutor is portrayed as manipulative and ignorant, and the good guy defensive advocate is portrayed as a defender of the truth. And in this telling, love and reason thus overcome prejudice and bigotry. Again, that story is not accurate, and it's almost the opposite of what actually happened in the real Scopes trial. Now, if you want to learn more about the Scopes trial and the propaganda that surrounded it, I do recommend the section about this in Defeating Darwinism by Philip Johnson. But all of this was an example of the standard propaganda that we still see in our day, trying to portray Christians as only concerned to hate those who oppose their ideas. One example that struck me a while back was a headline that said something like, "A certain state legislature is considering a bill to take away the freedom of certain students to use the bathroom of their choice." The headline puts the emphasis on the possible suppression of freedom, and who could possibly be for that? However, I think a more accurate and honest headline would be that the law was trying to protect young girls from being raped in the school's bathrooms by male predators pretending to be girls in order to gain access to girls in vulnerable spaces. Or the law was trying to protect young students from being indoctrinated and victimized by sexual predators and groomers. You see how this works? You can see this from different ways. That same proposed law could be described in a number of ways, some being more honest than others. These are examples of the power of propaganda to twist the truth. And the power of that kind of propaganda, which is prevalent today, is that it promises liberation from oppressors. Its rhetorical power is actually stolen from the Bible. However, that power is twisted when the story of liberation is actually used to be an instrument of oppression. Deceptive media can outshout the truth if we are not careful and discerning. But that's not really liberation, as promised, but a new form of control and oppression. Those who hold the microphone can decide who appears to be the heroes and villains, and the story told does not necessarily have any connection with reality. Now, I'm highlighting all this because it is a cautionary tale that we need to be very careful in testing the truth and the sources of our information. It is common these days for people to say that we don't distrust the media enough, and I agree. But I would also point out that this is not a new phenomenon in our day. The devil has always been a liar, and therefore, those on his side are always dripping with the same slimy strategy. Now, the historical point of all this is that the propaganda surrounding the Scopes trial made people think of fundamentalists only in terms of their overreaction to modernism, trying to portray Christians as only concerned to hate those who oppose their ideas. That kind of slander against fundamentalists was rarely true back in that day, and it's rarely true when it's used today. But back in that time, this kind of slanderous propaganda also made many fundamentalists react even further away from secular society. And you can't blame them for wanting to distance themselves even more from that kind of blatant dishonesty. Now, that brings us to the other category, which is labeled evangelicals. In the next section, we'll give a more thorough definition of evangelicalism and look at a few key leaders. And in later modules, we'll look at some later history of the evangelical movement. But for now, we'll primarily look at this movement that is now called evangelicals in terms of how they differed and separated in approach from the separatist fundamentalists. Evangelicalism was an attempt to navigate this overall tension. On the one hand, by being separate theologically, they rejected liberalism and kept to the fundamentals. But on the other hand, they also tried to remain, as much as possible, engaged socially and culturally, while focusing not primarily on resisting secularism, but rather on being faithful Christians. In other words, this is the approach that believed that the best defense is a good offense. And the evangelicals also tried to stop the pendulum swing away from liberalism before it went too far in the opposite direction, or to bring it back to biblical balance if it had already gone too far. So, historically, evangelicalism was a response to theological liberalism on one side, and wanting to avoid the excesses of some separatist fundamentalists on the other side. Evangelicalism was characterized by a cooperation across denominational lines. In other words, an evangelical Presbyterian had much more in common with an evangelical Baptist than with a liberal Presbyterian. And there were many parachurch organizations and societies, which we'll cover in a later section, such as Bible societies, missionary societies, etc., just to name a few. And there was information sharing and partnering in mission among evangelicals, in the National Association of Evangelicals, and publications such as Christianity Today, as well as a growing subculture, such as Christian radio, Christian TV stations, Christian books and bookstores, Christian music, and Christian schools and colleges. The history of some of these things will also be developed in a later section. And later, we'll see in a future section, evangelicals started to re-engage more vigorously in social and political issues. Now, that's just a brief overview of evangelicals, much of which will be elaborated in later sections. The strategy of the evangelicals was to stop or reverse the pendulum swing trends that we looked at earlier. Instead of fighting on the enemy's terms, the evangelicals tried to fight the enemy, but they tried to do it on God's terms. Instead of fleeing the world, they did withdraw to some extent to protect their families, to keep from supporting liberal institutions, but mainly as a safe fortress from which to stage their recapture of the public square, which had been lost, as solid ground from which to engage the lost world. And instead of anti-intellectualism, they rejected secular assumptions and presuppositions, and in doing that, they tried to outthink them. They tried to do better scholarship and build better academic institutions and better media outlets to serve better churches and also to do outreach to win the world and to reverse the downward trends in society. Those are general descriptions of those two diverging approaches that we now call the fundamentalists and the evangelicals. And these represent a spectrum of approaches. And these descriptions are not true for everyone in either camp. But I think they're helpful overall categories to help us understand different ways that the church in North America thought and did ministry in this portion of history. Now, by way of brief evaluation, based on the stereotypical division that we've seen, I think we should be fundamentalists in the original sense of being faithful to the fundamentals of the Christian faith. This description is true of those called separatist fundamentalists and those called evangelicals. But I don't think we should be fundamentalists in the sense that the word came to mean. That is what we're labeling separatist fundamentalist. This negative connotation is what most people now think of when they hear the term fundamentalist. And this started out partly as a deceptive slander because many of the Christians at that time were not like this. But unfortunately, some were. Some did become narrow-minded, anti-intellectual, known more for what they were against than what they were for. And we should not follow that example, even if some still accuse us of doing so. And again, I'll remind you that this only defensive bunker mentality can be appropriate if it is part of our strategy. But if we lack an offense that goes out and wins the world, we have a truncated, limited faith. Rather, we should be like the original fundamentalists, simply faithful Christians who love the Lord and His truth and stood firm in it. And we should be like the evangelicals who also tried to communicate the truth clearly, intelligently, and effectively in an academically responsible way. So, what can we learn from this history? How can we live in this tension? How can we avoid either extreme of giving into the world or of withdrawing too much from the world? Well, let me remind you of two rules that we saw in the History of Christianity 1 course when we studied the early apologists. First is keep the Bible as both your primary authority and your functional authority. Make sure you test everything by Scripture. Make sure you care more what Scripture says than what a biased media or public opinion says. And the second rule is that our apologetics should follow our theology. Our theology should not follow our apologetics. And in this section, we saw that this second rule actually cuts both ways. We could allow our apologetics to drag us too close to a sinful world so that we compromise our theology in order to connect with that world. Don't do that. Or we could allow our apologetic rejection of some things to lead us to reject all things so that our rejection of liberal theology leads to a rejection of all theology, so that our rejection of sinful culture leads to a rejection of all cultural engagement. Don't do that either. Like we saw in the prior section, we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Neither should we keep the bad for the sake of the good. But if we were to make either of those mistakes, the modernists would still be setting the agenda and determining our response. We can't let them control what we think or do. If liberal theologians believe in eating food and drinking beverages, does that mean that we should starve and die of thirst? No, of course not. Please don't do that. If we withdraw from the world in some cases, it should not be driven by reacting against the principles of the world. It should be driven by obedience to Christian principles. It should be led by God's revelation. We should always be led by good theology more than we are driven away from bad theology. Always be active and strategic instead of being reactive and manipulated. Make sure your theology from God directs your interactions with non-Christian people and ideologies. Don't allow them to set the agenda. Don't fight on their terms or their turf. Rather, follow where God is going and do what God is doing. As Jesus said, don't be of the world, because He's rescued you from the world and recreated you as part of the new humanity in His image. But be in the world, because He is sending you as His agent to proclaim His glory and His gospel, and to be salt and light in the dark and bland world. And then the third rule I want to remind you of is one I briefly mentioned in an earlier section concerning Abraham Kuyper. That is the idea that Christ should be involved as Lord in every part of life, in every aspect of society. Should Christ be involved in academics? Absolutely. Should Christ be involved in politics? Yes. Aha, you might be thinking, huh, does that mean that Christ should be involved in criminal gangs? They're a part of life. Well, yeah, you smart aleck. Jesus should be involved even in criminal gangs, if only to tell them to repent and stop being criminal gangs, which I think is the same thing you would probably say to many politicians. Should Christ be involved in Hollywood? Yes, but not to go along with what they're doing, rather to tell them, stop remaking older movies and pushing ungodly ideologies. Come up with something creative and good for a change and morally edifying. That means as Christians, we should work through how our Christianity makes a difference in everything that we do, every role that we play. And that may also mean that we should take on new roles and new tasks that have been neglected, so that we can be salt and light in every part of the world, all the while guarding our hearts and primary authorities. If we follow these three guidelines, I think we will be better prepared to achieve the things that the evangelicals were trying to accomplish and avoid the mistakes both of the theological liberals and the separatist fundamentalists. All right, now let's review. After the fundamentalists had split from the modernists, they divided it into two main approaches, which, for lack of better terms, we labeled the separatist fundamentalists and the evangelicals. Both of these groups basically shared the same theological distinctives, but differed in the way that they interacted with the hostile surrounding cultures. The fundamentalists sometimes tried to fight on the enemy's terms, but mostly withdrew, sometimes into anti-intellectualism. The evangelicals tried to engage and win the world while still remaining separate and distinct from the false presuppositions and ideologies, and challenging them with biblical presuppositions and truth. The evangelicals cooperated across denominations and created a distinctly Christian subculture. And we looked at some principles to help us navigate the tension of living among an ungodly culture. And that leads us to some discussion and application questions. First, describe the differing approaches between the fundamentalists and the evangelicals. How are they similar? And how are they different? What good examples did you find in either group? What was good about it? Why did you think it was good and faithful? And how specifically can you imitate and apply this good principle or principles? And then what mistakes or dangers did you find in either group? What was bad and why was it dangerous? What was dangerous about it and what bad things resulted? And how can you and your local church protect yourself from making similar kinds of mistakes? Second, in your own words, describe the tension inherent in these approaches that we covered in this section. What are the two extremes to be avoided on either side of the tension? How did the fundamentalists try to solve this tension? And how did that turn out? How did the evangelicals try to solve this tension? And how did that turn out? What did you learn from either approach that will help you to navigate this tension in your own life? And how do you plan to apply this insight in your own life and ministry? And finally is the open-ended question, what else did you learn? And how does it specifically apply in your own life and in your local church? Now, I hope this has given you plenty to think about and discuss. And now we will pause for discussion. Take your time to think and talk these things through. And when you come back, we'll look at some guiding principles. So pause the video now. Now, welcome back for some guiding principles. For the first principle, I'll just remind you of the three rules that we talked about earlier. Guard your primary functional authority, make your theology drive your apologetics, not vice versa, and apply your Christianity to every area of life. I've already described these in detail, so I won't do it again now, but these are still very important guiding principles we should seek to deeply understand and apply. The second principle is along the same lines. Guard your theological essentials and guard your cultural engagement. Hold on to the truth of God, but also connect it to everything else. Don't neglect either of these important things, because they are both important. I'll remind you of the illustration of the barrel I used in the section about German pietism. If a barrel is made up of planks of different lengths, it can only be filled to the level of its shortest plank. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Your theology is weakened if your engagement is weak, and your engagement is weakened if your theology is weak. Therefore, work to be strong in both of these. Now, let's be honest. This is not going to happen just because I said it. It won't happen just because you understand and agree with what I'm saying. It will only happen if we all take it to heart and are thoroughly convinced of its importance. If we cultivate and pursue a love of the truth, a full trust in God's veracity, and a passion for theological faithfulness, and if we cultivate a love for the lost and a desire to see the people around us brought to Christ and all the blessings that he brings. Unless God's people step up and value these things and act on these things, no amount of good advice will suffice. So don't just be hearers, but be doers. Third, I would suggest that we be anti-intellectual. We should all have a thoughtful, well-informed faith. Now, of course, not every Christian is called to be an academic or an apologist. Some are called into the sciences or technology or some other life of the mind, and some are not. I'm not suggesting that we all should be. What I am saying is that we should all be lifelong learners in the things that truly matter. We should know what we believe and why, and continually grow in that knowledge. We should not drift along with whatever everyone else thinks. Rather, we should cultivate a clearly Christian worldview. That means we should lead and not follow. That also means we should regularly turn off the TV and pick up a good book. Ideally, a good, true, and substantial book that helps us grow in true and significant knowledge. And then finally, to whatever extent we're living in an ungodly culture, which is true of everyone to some extent, we should live counterculturally while still confronting the ungodly culture with a better culture. We should not think and live like the ungodly world around us. We need to be different. Someone once said, a dead fish always goes with the flow, only a living fish can swim against the stream. And we should try to do it better to the degree that the world will see that the Christian way is better and want what we have. Countercultural while confronting ungodly culture with better culture. That might mean creating alternate institutions, and that means striving to do it better than the world around us, and that usually means not playing by their rules, but rather conforming to God's revelation. And that means not seeking their approval, but God's approval. And that means doing it with love, grace, and passion, so that it will be attractive to all. Not by their standards, but because it connects with the way that God has created everyone to be. And that is the best of what the evangelicals and all faithful Christians have been striving towards throughout history. Now, we cannot do this on our own, but who knows what God can do through us. Now, here's where I tell you that there's so much more that we could have covered, and I don't say that as some cliche or excuse. I say it because it's true. And I say it to encourage you to want to learn more on your own, because there is so much more good stuff available as you go more in depth than we are able to cover in this course. But I do hope that you've learned a lot from what we were able to cover, and I pray that God will use this to inspire and direct you how you can contribute to fulfilling such a vision to be in the world, but not of the world, to not be conformed to the world, but to be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you can be an instrument for the transformation of others and even for entire societies. In the next section, we'll look more in depth at the evangelicals, defining them in more detail and talking about a few key leaders and accomplishments. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for watching.